From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
This budget is one the Coalition would never have imagined itself delivering. It's dominated by debt and deficits and a climate of extreme doubt about the future. Today we talk to Matthias Cormann, who's been Finance Minister since the start of this government but is leaving Parliament at the end of the year. We also speak with Labour's Katie Gallagher, who is Opposition Spokeswoman on Finance. Matthias Cormann, I want to start with a clarification. The government is getting some heat for making the tax cuts look bigger than they actually are by benchmarking them against 2017-18. On that benchmark, someone on 120,000 gets a cut of $2,745. Could you tell us what this budget does to the tax that someone would otherwise pay?
Well, what we've done is we've benchmarked it against situation before we introduced our personal income tax relief legislation.
I understand that.
So, I mean, the costing has been done on the basis of, we are bringing forward personal income tax relief that was legislated in 2017-18 and in 2018-19. So 2017-18 is the appropriate benchmark, and the numbers, of course, have been published. And, what we've done in relation to low and middle income earners is bring forward that income tax relief by 2 years, as well as at the lower income end, extending the low and middle income tax offset by another year, which means that for those people who already had a tax cut baked in through previous tax cut legislation are essentially getting an additional benefit, doubling up the tax relief for 1 year.
Yes, and the benchmark is in the budget and in the budget papers, but could you just clarify what that taxpayer would get out of this budget alone, taking away what he's already got?
The costing has been done on the basis that we've published it, and it's clearly up to more than $2,500 for an individual, and indeed,
I mean, against 2017,
against 2017-18, which is the relevant benchmark here.
Yes, but can you make it any clearer for what they get compared to what they would otherwise be paying now?
Well, I've been very clear.
All right. Now, this is your last budget, but you'll still be around for the budget update in December. Will we have an early idea by then if this budget is working, and will the government be willing to respond to any need for changes then?
Well, the government always assesses, monitors, considers all of the economic information, all of the data that comes through, and we constantly, on an ongoing basis, make judgments on what, if any, further decisions need to be made, depending on what happens. I mean, clearly, when this unexpected crisis event hit in early this year, one in a 100-year pandemic with serious implications for our economy and jobs, we immediately responded by taking measures to protect people's health, boosting our health system, cushioning the blow on the economy and jobs, and providing increased support to those Australians who lost their job. And in this budget, we are putting forward our plan to get Australia out of this COVID recession and get the maximize the strength of the economic and jobs recovery moving forward. But between any budget and any budget update, as a matter of course, the government always will consider how our measures are getting implemented, what the effect is on the ground, how the data continues to evolve, and even as adjustments to policy settings are required, we'll continue to consider them and make them.
One of the repeated themes of this government is the need for a more flexible labour market. Doesn't your job scheme for younger workers fly in the face of that principle?
Not at all. I mean, the hiring credit for younger Australians deals with a specific structural challenge connected to a recession. I mean, we are in the COVID recession. We want to get out of this recession. And the experience from previous recessions has shown that younger Australians, those who were about to get into the labour market or had only just been in the labour market, are more exposed to ending up as long-term unemployed if they get entrenched in a reliance on job seeker type income support payments. And workers like beyond 35 years of age with a track record in the workforce with much more experience and demonstrated performance are much more prepared to demonstrate their employability and their job readiness, when the economy recovers and when jobs are restored and new jobs are created, compared to the younger cohort, which is more vulnerable, in the aftermath of a recession. More experienced workers, are already a couple of steps ahead, and that is why we have structured these hiring credits the way we have.
Now, you say this scheme will support 450,000 people into jobs. What are the assumptions behind this number? It seems a very large number.
Well, it's based on Treasury costings. Clearly it's based on an assessment of, how many people are, on job seeker in that age cohort and what the expected recovery is going to be. And it's based on an assumption that a business that is considering taking on new employees, in that sort of age cohort is, likely to take advantage of this opportunity to defray some of the costs of hiring those additional employees.
Are there any assumptions about the retention rate for these workers? Because they're only being subsidised for a year. Will a large proportion of them, in effect, be just getting a year of supported work experience?
This is a support that is provided to business that is considering hiring new, younger workers, and it's at a time when we're coming out of the COVID recession. I mean, as the economy continues to recover and as those young Australians, supported through the hiring credit, are in employment over a 12-month period for a minimum of 20 hours a week, they clearly have the opportunity to demonstrate their contribution, their performance, their worth. As the economy continues to recover, businesses continue to grow and actually are looking to hire more people, then those young Australians will be very well positioned for those opportunities.
Now, the Institute of Public Affairs and their free market soulmates of many Liberals say a budget surplus won't return until 2038-39 at best. When do you think the budget could return to surplus?
Well, I'm not sure on what basis they're making that projection. I think it'll be pretty difficult, particularly from where we sit today, to make projections all the way to 2038, 18 years from now. I mean, clearly what we are reflecting in the budget papers is that we will have a deficit of 11% as a share of GDP in 2020-21, and that is projected to reduce to a deficit of 1.6% as a share of GDP over the medium term by the end of the decade. And, in an Australian context, that, is, obviously a significant deficit this year. But I hasten to add, fundamentally, the reason here is because of a sustained drop in revenue on the back of an economy that, even though it will start growing again, will be on a lower trajectory over the next decade, and as such will generate less revenue than had previously been anticipated. On the payment side, all of our fiscal support measures in aggregate will provide a spike, will provide temporary crisis level fiscal support over a limited period, and what the budget papers show is that after just a few short years the payment trajectory is back aligned with the payment trajectory before the crisis hit in our half-yearly budget update. And there's a graph in the budget papers, budget paper 1, page 3-30, that demonstrates that very clearly.
So the budget funds 23,000 new aged care home packages at a cost of more than $1.5 billion. But the waiting list is over 100,000 for these packages. Isn't this a very small drop in a very large and needy ocean?
We have more than tripled the number of home care places, more than tripled. They're now above 180,000. And I think you'll find that today. You know, most people who are on a waiting list are getting some services. Of course, there's always more that needs to be done. I mean, how many people are on the waiting list is probably not as significant as how long those people have to wait before they get some level of support, before they can get increased levels of support. I mean, this is another $1.5 billion. I mean, all up in this budget, we're providing $2.7 billion additional funding to the aged care sector. Of course, we're very conscious that we need to continue to do more, and you know, we will, you know, as we can.
What's the justification for holding off until the end of the year to make a decision about what level the base amount of JobKeeper will be set at?
Well, you know, still today, the JobSeeker payment is materially higher than it was before this crisis. It sits at $250 a fortnight above where it was. And to, I mean, to be honest, like, that is higher. That is still higher than what, you know, various welfare organizations were asking us to increase the job seeker payment by, you know, when the crisis first hit.
I mean, we're talking about the base level for the future.
No, I understand the question, and I'm getting to it. Now, that was a crisis response. We always knew that that would cause some distortions, and it has caused distortions. I mean, we are getting reports from quite a number of businesses who say that they're struggling to convince, you know, people on job seeker payments to take on work because, you know, clearly, you know, job seeker payments at the level that they've been at without, you know, mutual obligation for an extended period, you know, when the crisis initially hit, was providing a disincentive to people to actually take on work that was available. Now, what we want to do in the next few months is to assess how, you know, the economy continues to recover, what is happening in the employment market. This is still a rapidly evolving situation, and it can, you know, there've been surprises on the upside too. I mean, the unemployment rate is well below where Treasury had feared it would be, and you know, employment jobs recovery has been stronger than we had feared it might be by now. And you know, depending on what happens over the next few months, we'll make judgments informed on the data as it continues to develop, and we'll make that judgment closer to the end of the year.
Now, you've been finance minister for seven budgets, and for many years you attacked debt and deficit, and now you're defending extraordinary levels of debt and deficit. What does that do to the head of a finance minister?
Well, you are comparing apples with oranges. I mean, the global financial crisis was a blip compared to what we're dealing with now. I mean, the global financial crisis...
I'm not saying you don't
but you must find it a bit discombobulating.
No,
you're suggesting that somehow we are doing the same as what was done then, and we're not. I mean, firstly, and if I might get one answer out in a straight run, that would be very, very helpful. The global financial crisis caused a contraction in the global economy of 0.1%. The global pandemic that we're dealing with has caused a contraction in the global economy of 45 times the size, 45 times the size, at 4.5%. Furthermore, the government at the time put a lot of money into new programs that were not well thought out, like the Pink Belts program and other. There was a lot of waste, which it wasn't well targeted, and there was a lot of increases in expenditure that baked in structural burdens into the budget bottom line. A lot of the expenditure at the time was structural, and what was meant to be crisis level expenditure became the new base from which expenditure grew from there on in. That is not what we're doing. And budget paper 1, page 3-30 shows you that very clearly. We have made temporary targeted commitments using existing programs and directly designed to support the economy, to support businesses, to support working families and keep people connected to their employer, and to support Australians who lost their job through no fault of their own. And I mean, we were dealing with a million people losing their job in 1 month as a direct result of the COVID pandemic hitting our economy. I mean, the proportions are completely different. Our response has been more targeted. It's time limited, and it is not baking in structural burdens into the budget bottom line. So it's a very, very different circumstance. And what I would say, of course, it's up to government in the context of a real crisis to step up and provide support. I mean, the first 6 years that we were in government, we worked very hard to repair the budget, to get ourselves back into a more sensible fiscal position. We returned the budget to balance, which stood us in very good stead. We were in a stronger position than just about any other country around the world going into this crisis. To provide the necessary fiscal support that was required because of the work that we did during our first 6 years in government.
Your usual budget role as finance minister has been finding cuts and warding off spending proposals. Did you do any of that this time?
Well, you know, the role of the finance minister actually is to ensure that we spend only as much as necessary and as little as possible, and to ensure that we have a quality, efficient and effective allocation of taxpayer resources. And that is what we've done in our first six budgets, and that's what we've done in this budget. And, you know, clearly, when you're dealing with the economic impact of a global pandemic of this magnitude, governments have to step up and provide the sort of support that we have, because otherwise the level of economic and social disruption around the community that would have happened would have delayed the recovery and made it for a weaker recovery than what we are working to secure for Australia now.
And finally, in terms of your role as finance minister, which was the hardest of these seven budgets?
You know, clearly the first one, as we had to set the policies in trying to turn that trajectory around that we inherited. We inherited from our predecessors a weakening economy, rising unemployment, and a rapidly deteriorating budget position. And we had to make difficult decisions at that time, which led to about $250 billion worth of budget bottom line improvements, over the medium term. And this budget, you know, clearly has been a difficult one, not just the budget moment itself. I mean, the whole period from the end of January to this budget, I mean, this whole nine-month period, you know, has been, you know, incredibly intense and incredibly challenging, because you do want to make sure you do the right thing by the Australian people. You do want to make sure that you provide the right level of support in a sensible fashion. And, you know, clearly every day we very carefully assess and consider how we can best do that.
Matthias Cormann, thank you very much for talking with us today on an incredibly busy day for you. And we hope to talk to you for a more reflective look back on your career before you leave Parliament.
Very happy to at the right time.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And in a footnote to that interview, the Prime Minister has now announced that Senator Cormann will be nominated by Australia to run as a candidate for Secretary General of the OECD. Katie Gallagher, the opposition after the budget says what it said before, that the government has no plan and the people are being left behind. But there is clearly a plan to try to drive recovery via breaks, tax breaks for business and tax cuts for individuals. It's a question of whether the plan is the right one. So isn't your no plan argument really another two-word slogan?
Not at all. I think what we've seen in this budget is a lot of spending, $1 trillion of deficits for as far as the eye can see, and no long-term plan for the nation or for the economic recovery. It seems to me it's a range of different measures, a very short term, most of them, lots of money being pumped in, but lots of people being left behind. And the budget's all about choices. The Prime Minister's made those choices and he's chosen to leave a lot of areas either unaddressed or a lot of people without support.
Who specifically is left behind?
Well, I think certainly in the issues that we've seen in the last 7 months, there's, job seeker, they're left hanging. I mean, frankly, that's just a mean decision. It's October, the corona supplement's due to expire in December. There is absolutely no reason why the government shouldn't address that. It means, 1.6 million people are left hanging right up until the end of this year. JobKeeper, the reductions there. We know there's three and a half million people surviving on that payment. You know, there's some initiatives, sure, for people under the age of 35 and apprentices and trainees, but we know the fastest group joining JobSeeker is old, you know, women over the age of 40, and this budget does nothing for them. Social housing, aged care, all of these areas unaddressed in the budget and all big pressure points for a lot of Australians.
On aged care, for example, obviously the government is still waiting for the report from the Royal Commission early next year. Isn't that reasonable?
Well, there was some recommendations in the special report that was released last week.
Which it has accepted.
They've accepted, but they had resource requirements around PPE and extra support going into aged care.
They have announced $40 million for that.
That's right. But again, I think the real pressure points in aged care remain unfixed. And we've seen those as a really vulnerable cohort in the pandemic. You know, frankly, home care places spread over 4 years isn't going to meet the pressures that older Australians have. And the government knows it. They've known it for years. I just don't buy this line that they've got to wait for the Royal Commission in order to understand what the real areas for reform are. I think they know it already and they're making a choice about when they respond to that.
When you talk about a long-term plan, what are you specifically talking about here? What would be the headline elements of the plan you're looking for?
Well, I think it's about, you know, serious reform, whether it be in how you, the vision you have going forward for, you know, addressing those pressure points in the pandemic, women, supporting areas like childcare, which we know, again, is a real area of pressure. A lot of the measures they've done in training are for 1 year. I mean, frankly, I don't know an apprenticeship that lasts 1 year. You know, most of them last much longer than that. So there's a lot of short-term kind of patching holes with some of these measures. But as to what you're going to do around, you know, your productivity agenda, what you're going to do to address people that are struggling, how you're going to fix up the social security system in the long term, none of that has been answered in this budget.
Is this huge spending budget actually spending enough?
I mean, I guess time will tell, won't it? We are spending a lot of money, whether that's the right amount or the amount that's going to deal with the economic challenges that we face, I think is an open question. I mean, it's hard. We've got to go through all of this in estimates with Treasury to understand a lot of the thinking behind the timing and the size and the scale of their economic response. But you know, I think people are right to say $1 trillion debt, net debt, and deficits for as far as the eye can see, well beyond 2030, are we actually getting a good bang for our buck? And I think that is an open question for us.
Are you worried about the debt?
Well, we've always said, I mean, it's the government that's been completely hypocritical on this. And, you know, absolutely outrageous that they would claim a debt and deficit disaster, one-fifth of what the country is facing now. We have remained consistent at all times. When the economy requires government spending to support jobs and to support people, that should be provided. What we want to make sure is that this money that's being spent is high quality and delivering outcomes for people on the ground, whether it be jobs, helping them, you know, secure housing, training, whether it's enough to put food on the table. They're the outcomes we want to see. And we do have concerns about the quality of the spend. Time will tell whether some of the big measures actually deliver quality spending, but also some of the money they funnel through their rorts and funds that they've got a predilection for, and particularly the Prime Minister, there's a fair bit of money being funneled through those. So for us, it's the quality of the spend. There will need to be a plan about paying down debt in the longer term, but I think the focus at the moment, despite the government's hypocrisy, has to be around investments in the economy to deliver an outcome.
So you think the debt is manageable because, after all, it could be inherited by a Labor government if Labor won the next two or three elections?
Well, it's going to have to be manageable,
isn't it? One of the next two or three elections.
It's going to have to be manageable. It is there. I mean, the budget papers writ large, you know, gross debt will peak at over $1.7 trillion. Net debt will peak at, in the budget papers, from what we can see, just under $1 trillion. So, you know, there is, you know, it will have to be managed. But again, we have to make sure that at the end of the day, when we are paying back all of this, that we've actually got the outcomes we need, which is, you know, people back into work, families supported, our older Australians cared for, and young people given the opportunities they need to have a good career. They're the things that we will measure this budget by.
Now, Labor said it will support the tax cuts, and it's indeed previously called for them to be brought forward. But do you think they're the best way of injecting stimulus at this time?
As part of an overall package, I think they definitely have a role. And so we were waiting to see how that would be packaged up. We've called for stage two to be brought forward. We're comfortable with that. We think there is sense putting money back into working people's pockets. But it has to be part of the overall recovery strategy. It can't be tax cuts and that's it. And so we think there are still gaps that the government should have addressed in this budget. We're surprised they didn't. It's not like they don't understand the issues, but the government's clearly backing business as the main driver of the economy, you know, economic recovery, and they've made no secret about that. We think, you know, there was opportunity to put some investment in the social side of society, you know, to make sure that we're bringing everyone with us and not leaving people behind.
Well, what about those business tax concessions? What will Labor's stand be on them? And would Labor in government have spent the money differently, that money?
Yeah, it's hard to know what Treasury served up to the government in terms of options around business investment. Obviously, business investment's been a problem for this government well before the pandemic started. Investment had been tanking, so that there had to be something done there. I don't know what all the options are. We'll try and find out. So it's hard to answer, you know, whether we would have gone this big. It's clearly a massive lick of money, and we hope that it delivers what they say it will deliver. But we've only, you know, we're trying to work through some of the budget papers now. I mean, I know we got the papers at 3:30 yesterday, and we've got at 7:30 the government was demanding that we pass the entire thing. So we do have areas where we'd go, well, actually, you know, you don't have a really good record on a lot of the detail that underpins some of these programs, and we would like to understand more about it. But I think we would be inclined to support them at this stage. But again, we would like more time to understand all the detail.
Now, you've spoken about the Senate estimates process looking at the detail of the budget, but what about the COVID committee that you head? Will you be using that to probe into the weeds?
Sure. Beyond estimates, we will definitely. I mean, part of its main job has been to focus on the economic side, and this is a big part, obviously. This is the largest, biggest, massive spending budget for some time. So we'll definitely be looking at that beyond in November, I would say, and also getting perspectives back. You know, we need to hear from the community groups and all of those that represent a lot of people that don't have a voice around the Prime Minister's table about what needs to be done to bring everyone with us in the recovery.
Now, just finally, that committee has produced some very interesting evidence, and you've had the players before you, the main players, in real time. What are the couple of most important things that you think the committee has, in fact, extracted?
Yeah, it's hard to say. We've had 38 hearings, more than 300 hours of evidence. And I think we've had something interesting come out of every hearing. I think we really exposed some of the failures in aged care. And I think the other main takeout for me would be a lot of announcements, much harder on the delivery side for this government. They, you know, announced JobMaker 100 days ago, and now they're putting some flesh on the bones of that scheme through the budget. So I guess this is the message for us out of this budget too. The glossy brochures have been printed, the sell job's on. You know, we need to make sure this government actually delivers what they promise rather than just announcing it, because it's something the Prime Minister is very good at.
Katie Gallagher, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Michelle.
That's all for our Budget Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.